Good afternoon. My name is Reggie Smith. I cover fintech stocks here at J.P. Morgan, and I am pleased and excited to interview the management team at Pagaya. We have Gal Krubiner and Michael.
Kurlander.
They're here with Pagaya. I want to start. Let you guys kind of give your background story. Like, what is Pagaya? What problem are they solving? And how they go to market?
So, Reggie, thank you so much. Both Kurlander and myself are happy to be here.
We just joked about that.
So we really appreciate the invitation. I think the first question for us is the most important one. And it's like, what inspired us? What made us open that business? And the long, short story of it is that there are still many consumers in the U.S. that are not getting the credit they deserve and therefore cannot achieve their personal goals in life. And when we think about it, we wanted to be as accurate and as possible relevant for the solution to be able to provide them that solution in the place where they need it. And it's most relevant when in the moment they are asking for credit, if something goes wrong, we are stepping in. So the mission statement of Pagaya is to provide more credit to more people in the U.S., no matter where they are or what they are asking for a loan. And I want to start with reading you one of the statements that one of the people that got a loan from Pagaya, that got a loan from Pagaya, shared, but didn't share with us, shared with the lender that she got the loan from, which is part of our network. So is writing, "To Best Egg," which is Marlette for the one who don't know, "Best Egg helped me consolidate my credit card debt into a manageable monthly payment. I was thinking Best Egg threw me a lifeline." Now let me tell you the interesting story here. You didn't see Pagaya. Pagaya was the one who did the underwriting and provided the capital for that. Is appreciating her lender, Best Egg, for doing that. While she doesn't know, it was all us behind the scene. So we made sure that the consumer is happy and got the loan that we was looking for. And in the same time, the lender got another customer to become a loyal customer. Like, they are out of the more than 1 million loans that Pagaya provided, 700,000 of them are a situation like that, that without Pagaya, it would have been declined. So the impact that we have on society and what we're making people change in their life is immense. And that was the mission statement, and that was the bottom of the reason why we started Pagaya.
Sure. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Maybe to make it a little realer for people, talk about, you know, what the typical flow is. You mentioned that this loan was declined and then you guys somehow stepped in. Maybe walk us through what this looks like from the customer's perspective and what's going on the back end as you...
Definitely. So from a customer perspective, he's going to ask for a loan, and the loan could be a buy now, pay later from Klarna. It can be an auto loan through a dealership asking LI. It can be a personal loan online through Marlette or Prosper or any other of our 25-plus partners. And then when the partner decides for its own reasons, could be that their history of credit is only 6.5 years and not 7. It could be that the FICO is 650, but their cutoff is 660. Whatever it is that they have, we are getting the application with all the information exactly in the same time before declining the customer. We are running that through our network AI, and we have unique data from more than 25 partners that is allowing us to have a deeper underwriting capabilities than most.
So you're underwriting parallel with the...
information that we have. And then we are approving that customer. The customer is getting the approval through the lender that he wanted to have the loan from them in the beginning. In our case, there was a Marlette. Let's assume it's an LI dealership. It's LI. On the screen, what he knows, what he feels, he knows that this is the lender he went to. He is getting the money from that bank. And on the back end, Pagaya is providing that money not from us. We're not a balance sheet lender, but from institutional investors that provided us a pool of capital to fund these loans. So from a consumer perspective, he just got a loan from a lender he chose. From a lender perspective, he got another customer that otherwise would have been going to a competitor. And from the institutional investor perspective, he has one-stop shop with many different markets and investment that he can go and invest in a very easy and coherent way working with Pagaya. Does that make sense?
It does. What? So thinking about AI and your machine learning algorithm, like what separates you guys from other AI lenders, and how are you able to really price that risk for these either lower FICO score or thinner credit file customers?
So a lot of it is coming from the immense amount of data that we are collecting. So the data that we have is coming from the full network that we have. We're talking about over 25 different partners. We're talking about different markets and asset classes. So we have a lot of knowledge in auto loans, a lot of knowledge in personal loan. We see now the purchases from the buy now, pay later.
How far back does that go?
And that goes, I would say, the actual production data that we have since 2006, and we have data even 10 or 20 years ago before from the credit bureaus. So very robust data set that combined with the changes in the macro and our ability to react very quickly to something as we see a phenomena, rather a specific channel, give us a much deeper comfort in order to be able to underwrite in different segments that one might be out of the very basic credit score that banks should have.
Are there any anecdotes like back testing or anything like that that kind of speaks to the effectiveness of how you're able to sort risk? Anything you can share there? If not, I totally understand as well.
Yeah, I think on a high level, you could appreciate that like AI generally is coming at like 40-50% more accurate in the ability to predict versus regression tools if you use a Gini score or any other type of things.
Got it. Okay. Thinking about your two-sided network, let's start on the partner side. Curious to hear like who you're working with, how those relationships come to be, maybe the selling process, and maybe your pipeline of new partners. Not giving names, but just like the magnitude of that pipeline, if you could share that, it'd be helpful.
The ex-banker would love.
Sure. Yeah, and maybe I'll give like a personal anecdote, which was I started at Pagaya about 2 years ago. One of my prior lives, I was at Goldman Sachs when we were building Marcus. And so the example Kyle talked about of the problem that Pagaya solves is one that I actually found when I was in my old seat, which is wanting to provide and get more customers, but then having either regulatory capital restrictions if you're a bank or just not the sophisticated credit underwriting capabilities if you're maybe different, newer type of institution. And Pagaya, as Gal described it, solves that problem. And so typically when we go into a new partner's office, that first conversation is actually very seamless, as you can imagine, because the questions that we ask are, do you want to have more customers? Do you want to earn, you know, more fees? And do you want to protect your franchise from other competitors that are trying to take those customers away? And so, of course, the answer to that question is always yes. Now, where it gets more complex is, as Gal is describing, there is a very long integration of, particularly with the large banks, of integrating in technologically because this is all happening automated. And so that process is, you know, the phase two, phase three. But the beginning part with the partner, we are complementing. Like we're not competing at all. We are exactly complementing. And the example Gal gave, the actual consumer still knows the brand of that partner. So from their perspective, it's very easy to want to onboard Pagaya. And we can now show with our history, we can produce between 20-30% incremental volume for a partner. So it's very material for them, which gets our partners very excited and leads to the growth that we've seen just in the last 5 or 6 years.
You referenced like large banks. Can you frame that? Are we talking top 10 banks, 10 to 20, or like what's the size there? And then a follow up with that, do you find that banks are in any way hesitant to share the data with you guys? And if so, like, are there workarounds around that? Like, how do you deal with that?
Maybe I'll start, and then I would say our solution works for the full range of partners. So we can and believe our product works very well for the largest banks in the U.S., top 10, and we're in discussions with a number of them right now. Also works for the smaller, either banks or fintechs, because we're solving different types of problems for each demographic, but we're fully automated, we're fully scalable, and so the actual integration and the process, it works very well for the biggest institutions in the U.S. And we've named a couple just in the last few quarters that we've onboarded, and we've got a strong pipeline behind that. So we're really excited about that.
And to the discussion about regulatory front of data sharing and all of that, when you, like, we are now in the stage where we are moving from working very strongly with the fintechs and non-bank lenders generally in the U.S., and we are entering into what we call our bank stage. And part of that is to do the shift from selling to, call it medium level, from size perspective, organizations to a true real enterprise sales from that perspective, and with the extra regulatory framework that comes with it. And that means not just on the data front, but like in the sense of like how really a Q&A process looks like, how much is your documentation of all the things looks like. And what we did in the last few years is to hire really the top of the art management that is coming from the banks and having an understanding of what does it take to do that. So Mike is a good example, but next to him there is Amol, which is the COO, was the COO of like Hong Kong Goldman Sachs, and Ashok Vasani, which was the CEO of Barclays UK, and Leslie Gillen, which was the chief marketing officer of JP Morgan Chase. So very strong individuals that has a good understanding and direction to what does it mean to be AAA from a bank perspective in order to be able to work with them. And you see that now in the integration that we are having that is influencing and making it available for us to actually conclude these transactions or these kind of like onboarding. To the data point, we are not using any data that is not fully FCRA compliant that is coming from TransUnion. We are very rigid about the things that we do and the method that we use. And there is a lot of work being done internally about the level of explainability of the models that we have and the ability to provide a lot of comfort for banks that are standing in front of the regulators and to be able to tell them, yeah, we are fully feeling comfortable with this type of stuff.
Well, so do you, so it sounds like you're using the same data that the credit agencies are. Are you overlaying something else that's been like randomized or how does that, like how do you, like what are you doing to make it better than, if you're using the same data, like how is yours better?
So the better is the depth of the data you're using. So you would be surprised to know that like most of the underwriters are kind of like using the top 10, 20 parameters. But there is much more in the credit bureau that algorithms like AI are actually opening that capabilities to be utilized. That's one thing. And the other piece is the intersection between all of them.
Right.
So like you have like, you know, the data from one specific partner, and that's what you've been seeing all the last 10 years with the biases of that marketing, that servicing, and that verification and so on and so forth. When you are duplicating that and seeing the same picture from 25 places, it's like when you look on a picture and you have different lanes, you see different things. You have a better ability to understand how they're being constructed, what are the issues. The same thing is happening in the network, in the AI network.
Got it. So you guys are using more data, and you're finding even deeper relationships that they're not capturing.
And it is, as Gal said, it's that vantage point that is very unique to Pagaya. When people ask, what's the data moat? It's that combination of all of the publicly available data that we have with 25 different lending partners' application flow. That combination is very, very powerful, and others can't. It's very hard to replicate that, and the AI is driven off of that quantity of information.
Got it. Okay, so we've talked about the partner side, we've talked about the data. What are you doing? Like, what's your value prop to investors, and like, how do you fund these loans? And
so, let me start, and then Mike, feel free to add. So, the institutional capital behind us is rather, I would say, impressive or unique. So GAC is one of our biggest backers. They they are doing a lot of the consumer credit and these type of asset classes through Pagaya. There are many other asset managers. We just announced a partnership with Angelo Gordon and Varde and Atlas that are the front leading of these type of asset classes, joining our network, looking for opportunities together. I think what we are offering, and so-called the name of the game in that place, is better returns and the ability to react very quickly to macro trends that are changing. And in 21, there were some spike in defaults, and we were the first ones to react and to take that into consideration. Unfortunately, people are sometimes mistaken that AI can predict the future. It can't. Mm. It can be just more relevant when things are happening and how to react. So that's point number one. Point number two is the fact that we have a very robust capital market capabilities that has been very strong in the last few years, being able to fund and to continue to grow the type of stuff. We're funding a year on a personal loan, something like north to $6 billion through these partnerships and the capital markets words. We are financing in the auto loans, big banks and capital markets, again, something like $2 billion already. So slowly but surely, we're becoming a big issuer and a big, massive driver for that. We are the biggest personal loan issuer in the U.S. In 2023. So a lot of deep relationships, a lot of
customization. ABS
in the personal loan.
Within personal loans. Yeah. So ABS issuers. So not the biggest origination.
No.
In person. Got it. Okay.
Biggest funder through ABS.
Understood.
So all of that giving us a unique ability to be very well funded. Maybe Mike, you want to add?
I would just say if you asked one of our investors what they like about Pagaya, I think what you'd hear is, number one, they're getting one-stop shopping. So because Pagaya is the network with 25 different lending partners, an investor coming in is getting access to up to 25 different lenders in one stop, as opposed to going individually to their unique profiles of each individual partner. So it's very efficient for our investors, and obviously there's a diversification benefit of that as well. And the other thing is, because of the funding structure, which is unique, we raise capital first, and then we deploy it, which is great for Pagaya. It keeps our balance sheet very light. But for investors, it also means that there's a certainty of cost of capital before the actual assets are generated. And in these markets where cost of capital is moving around a lot and it's quite volatile, that actually gives us a leg up in pricing, which allows us to deliver the returns that the investors are seeking. So they really like that from an actual results perspective.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, you talked about being the biggest ABS issuer within the personal loan space. I cover a few other names, and everybody's saying that, like, the ABS markets are tough and terrible. How have you been able to issue? Is it the fact that you know your cost up front and you can price better on the back end? Like, what's your secret sauce there?
So I think the secret sauce is consistent messaging and being able to provide the understanding of what's happening in the market because of that wide network. So we know exactly what to go after, which opportunity and which time. A lot of it is institutional relationships, that having the ability to anchor these type of transactions and to provide a lot of like stability to make sure that these deals are going to get done. And quite frankly, the paid shelf is one of the strongest shelf out there, so the liquidity for that shelf is much higher than others. So when you're an investor who wants to invest in that type of environment, usually you're going to the more well-known names.
Sure. I'm going to ask you a nerdy question since I have you here. Thinking about AI and underwriting, tell me if I'm thinking about this correctly. So the longer the loan is out, the more impact the general economy will have on the loan. And so there's not a lot of alpha in picking good loans there. Where the AI helps is in like eliminating those early stage losses and predicting that. Am I thinking about that right? What else can you say about AI underwriting to make it?
So I want to divide what you said to two parts. There is the macro angle and there is the micro angle. So the ability to know what's going to be the macro outside of like a year or two is very tough. And AI doesn't have that capability.
Right.
AI will be able to take into consideration what will be the reaction of a borrower to different type of scenarios and therefore to choose the scenario that is more balanced in between different macroeconomic scenarios. When you're talking about ability to price and to originate loans, it's rather interesting, but think about these loans. Usually their duration is something like 1.3 to 1.4. So while it's still 3 years, most of the payments are happening before, sometimes prepayment, interest rate, and so on and so forth. So you're getting to a point where kind of like 40% of the knowledge of what's going to happen is actually coming in the first 6 to 9 months. And the first 6 to 9 months has a very good correlation of what's going to be the return at the end, given everything is equal the same.
Right.
If things are not equally the same, you have some deviation of a percentage, 2%.
You're saying that the economy...
Staying the same.
Exactly. Okay.
Now, let's take that out of the equation. So you might have 1 or 2 points of how that could impact here or there. But the most of the information of the borrowers, that is, the AI is kind of like being able to predict and to see, and the most impact that it has on return is actually occurring in the first 6 to 9 months.
Got it.
And that's why it's so effective.
Cool. That makes sense. Thanks for that. I hope I didn't bore you guys. Real quick, can you talk about how you make money? You have a very unique revenue model. I think it's shifted in recent quarters, too. So, like, give us some background there.
Sure. Simply put, we make money as a network from both the partner side and from the investor side. So if you think about it, investors are paying us because we're out there selecting these individual assets that fit their profile to generate their target returns. And so we're making fees from investors on that side. And then you pointed to this, but more recently, we've actually grown on the partner side as we've become more and more impactful and beneficial to our partners. 20 to 30% of some of our partners' originations come from us. We've gone and actually negotiated agreements with our partners, similar to like a revenue sharing model. And so we're able to earn fees from both the investor side and the partner side. And what that amounts to is on our network volume, and we did $7.3 billion of network volume last year, think of it as a 9.5% to 10% take rate, which is the accumulation of those fees. And then on a net basis, less production costs, it ends up being, our target is 3 to 4%. And so our gross margin goes from a 10% overall take rate. We're paying ultimately the partners because they are the storefront, getting the customers' applications. They have to spend their marketing dollars. And so their fees come off the top line. And then our net return, our target, is 3 to 4% on that level of volume, which we see growing significantly in the future.
And what we like about it is that it provides a different level of stability and your ability to predict that you're going to get that revenue stream. Even if markets are a little bit more or a little bit less, it's much stronger. So it's exactly what you said. We almost changed the business model to a point where the stability and the predictability of that, it's much stronger for Pagaya.
Got it. And let's, we should have done this earlier, but let's frame the opportunity. I think you said almost $8 billion in originations last year. What markets are you in? How big are those markets? What's your penetration? What's your growth rate?
So from a TAM perspective, like talkable addressable market, you can think about the full consumer credit in the U.S. that is breaking down to the personal loans, auto loans, mainly in the near prime and the subprime. All these areas are areas we are controlling. We're actually owning a few percentage of the full market in the U.S. I think in personal loan is something like 5+% on an origination per year, and in our segments maybe 20 to 30%, right? On auto loans, we are finding our way.
Your segments being the declines?
The decline, like call it the 680 type of FICO, 700, 660, so-called the near prime space, or the lower prime. And then on the other part, which is the auto loans, we are talking about a few billions of dollars, which is like a market that is like 10x from what it's actually producing a year. So there is a lot of runway there. And a lot of the growth is going to come from auto. And we feel that we are now, with the announcement of Eli and others, kind of like figured the the long-term market fit strategy, and now it's to accumulate more and more. And we are getting there and happy about the growth, and a few others are in the pipeline to be able to become partners from that perspective. So these are the two major markets. And then next to them is the BNPL that we onboarded Klarna, as we know, which is maybe the most growing market from all of them because of what's happening in the internet and the ability to originate and to grow that. Think about even another interesting strat. Airbnb just announced that they onboarded with Klarna, right? Airbnb actually onboarded with Pagaya. It's just not well connected.
Right.
The practical side is that once you are connected to Klarna and Klarna is growing, you are growing with it. So on the BNPL, after we're going to get to the ramp-up place and the place we need to be, etc., the growth of Klarna and the BNPL is going to be the growth of Pagaya.
Sure.
Which is amazing, without a lot of work to be having on that.
Are the economics the same in the different verticals?
So at the end, yes, but like in early days, it takes time. So you first land, expand, and only then monetize, right? So you can imagine on the personal loan, there's no monetization in the buy now, pay later, much less monetization.
Right.
So it depends on the maturity. And the last ones is like credit card and SFRs, which are some things that we believe has a long of way to go and a lot of opportunity to capture. But now more in incubation mode for us.
Credit cards, I know. SSS what?
SFR, single family rents. Mike, you want to take it?
Yeah, SFR is a great opportunity. Less than 1% of single family rentals in the U.S. are institutionally owned at this point. So we see this massive opportunity where using Pagaya and our scale, we can attract institutional capital in the same way we do in the other products, invest that institutional capital in homes that we've identified through our AI because we're tracking credit trends across the entire U.S. So we feel like we have an alpha in identifying homes, using AI to even understand what types of renovations make the most sense to drive rental appreciation the fastest. And then we're generating returns for our investors just like we do in the other products. And so we're really excited about that as our fifth product and one that's got a huge market that we really have just started to penetrate.
And as part of that, we just acquired Darwin Home, which is an M&A we announced, and going to grow that platform massively. But again, on the incubation side.
That leads into two questions. One, I want to skip back real quick. Credit, what are you seeing just in terms of the economy, the consumer, real quick, and then I want to get into your M&A.
So economy from the borrowers we are used to, and personal loan is usually things happening before. Actually, the peak of delinquencies happened end of Q1, start of end of 21, start of 2022. So the first half of 2022. I think you heard the same, like Max talked about it yesterday here in the conference too. We feel the same. So the big inflation hit is already behind us from affordability perspective. I think that's something the market will realize soon.
Now, is that the consumer getting better or the underwriting has gotten tighter?
So I think consumer is getting, like, it's a little bit of both because, like, the consumers that didn't get that well and the underwriting was not good in finding them washed out from the system.
Got it.
That's really the way to think about it.
Okay.
So that's number one, or there were a lot of mispricing back then because interest rate was so low,
right.
And now there is the right pricing and so on and so forth. So that to your question.
Got it. So that makes sense. M&A, I know you raised $75 million in a preferred issuance. What is your strategy for M&A? Should we expect more? And, mm-hmm. and what types of assets are most interesting to you?
So M&A... Given the dislocation in the world from valuation perspective, both on the public and on the private, there are just like amazing companies that raise hundreds of millions of dollars and worth hundreds of millions of dollars that are now going to face what's being called, we know it from the world of corporate credit as like the maturity wall, but a different funding wall. And they will need to have a choice if to do a very dilutive type of like instrument that will take them another 3 or 5 years to get out of that situation, or maybe to potentially merge into a company like ourselves. So we found that there are great opportunities, great founders, people who knows to build products, teams, etc. and that instead of going to another round, down round with a lot of preference right. for others, maybe it's better for them to join Pagaya, get a little bit off the stock in a public traded company, and in the same time, giving some of the equity money to actually continue to grow and to kind of like build their baby. So that was the driver for Darwin. We see many more, and since we announced that, we are getting, I guess, a phone call every day.
Yeah,
it's just that to find teams and companies that are aligned with right. our strategy and has the right kind of like time to capture. So you need a few stars to align and right. cultural and all of that. But the opportunity out there is immense, and it's relevant only when you're taking ownership of a strategy and not just investing and letting it be in the same way.
Got it. Did you give me when that Armageddon time period is for funding for everybody? When is that?
So I think it's like until the end of this year for the smaller ones. So usually the bigger ones, the growth equity, the kind of like the strong, big, late-stage fintechs, when they raised in 21, they raised hundreds of millions of dollars, so they have more runway. But if you were at $200 million private company, most probably you didn't want to dilute yourself too much. You raised $30 to $40 million. You told yourself there is an 18 months until the next fundable stage.
Sure.
You saw what happened 6 months ago. You already downsized the company by 30%. You thought, okay, it's going to give you another 9 months. The 9 months is about to get over. Got and then it. Tough decision needs to be made.
I understand.
And I'll just add, in terms of what is interesting to us and exciting, we're operating in the world of consumer and where we can be disruptive in helping, you know, consumers get access to more credit. So if you think about that, there's a ton of products that we haven't mentioned yet that could be accretive to us. And so in terms of what we're thinking about, it's either, you know, a company that would be an additional type of product that we have yet to participate in that allows us to, could allow us to grow inorganically into that new product.
It would be a credit product or not necessarily.
Could be.
Like solar loans, like home improvements.
Sure, exactly.
Like,
or in the example of Darwin, what we got really excited about was Darwin was one part of the single family rental vertical that was doing had a specific property management expertise that we would have had to outsource. So either one of those examples is really interesting. And in the world of consumer in the U.S., there's no shortage of opportunities.
Got it. We got 90 seconds left. I'm going to ask you, what is the market missing about Pagaya?
So I think what the market missing about Pagaya is three things. First, that the growth that is embedded in what is happening these days is still existing high. And the right way to measure it is not where the revenues are, because that's just you have two sides of things that are happening, right? So, like, we are continuing to grow, but the economy goes against us, so it looks like we're going slower. But once that cloud is going away, the acceleration of growth is going to be 2 or 3x. The best way to show it is the application flow that goes us so massively and didn't stop and continuing to. And that's the most important measurement. I think that's number one. And number two, I think that, like, compared to these type of business models, the stability and the fact that we didn't decline at all but managed to keep and to become EBITDA positive and increase the EBITDA is speaking strongly to the how strong the business model is and taking, in my eyes, a lot of the risks off the table and therefore should be repriced. That's my two. Yeah.
Have you guys given a target EBITDA profile, like at maturity, and kind of what's the path to that real quick? I know we don't have
So in 10 seconds, we think we see a clear path to $25 billion of volume. At our 3 to 4% gross margin, that's $1 billion, call it, of gross margin. Our operating costs, we think, can be we're right now $200 million, even if that goes up by 50%, you're at $300 million, that's $700 million of EBITDA.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen this year, but we see a path to that in the future years.
We did it.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Reggie. Cool. Appreciate that.
Thank you.